Hello, you're listening to On the Point, the News Collective's show, formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Alex Trabulsi.
And I'm Akshay Kulkarni. It's Friday, October 23rd. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamedium-speaking Musqueam people.
Today, we'll be listening to an interview by Akshay Kulkarni with Dr. Cheryl Lightfoot about the conversation surrounding Indigenous issues during the campaign, as well as what Indigenous people are thinking about the prospect of an NDP re-election.
Then News Collective reporter Grace Jenkins gives us a rundown of the anti-mask rallies in Vancouver. To close, we'll be having an update about the overdose prevention site in Yaletown and some final hot takes before the election tomorrow.
But first, we have an interview with researcher and political scientist Melanie Thomas about the sexist and racist power dynamics at play in politics, as well as the gender gap we see in the electoral process. We talked about this a lot last week after Jane Thornthwaite's sexist comments about Boon Ma, and Dr. Thomas had a lot to say. Let's take a listen.
Yeah, so thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me this early in the morning.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So jumping right into it, the BC Liberals leaked video with sexist comments on Boon Ma has been discussed a lot over the past week, and you have been interviewed by News 1130, I think, for the coverage of their events. So could you give us your analysis of the situation at this time, and specifically how white feminism is at play here?
Yeah, so the thing that I found really, like, I have a hard time putting a label on, like, the emotional reaction I had on it, because I have a number of concerns. So part of it is that you can't understand the sexism without understanding the racism. And this is one of the things I've been frustrated with several days after watching this play out, where it is very obvious that it's a white woman who's using racist stereotypes to inform the sexist attack. And so, like, there's no way that this works without this combination of really gross ideas about race and how they interact with gender. And I find that race element, like a typical Canada, we don't really want to acknowledge the issues with racism that we have. Like, we have them. We are a settler colonial state. Racism is baked into, like, every aspect of Canadian politics. We just tend to want to minimize or, like, just not acknowledge just how racist a lot of Canadian political history and a lot of current Canadian politics is. For me, the really unfortunate thing was, there are many unfortunate things, so that this is another woman who's attacking a woman and, like, doing it on racist grounds and, like, using racism to inform her sexism, and then proceeding, and then the very first statement that was made of the, like, I support all women, I broke through the glass ceiling too. And it's like, actually, no, this is not the same. You don't share an experience here. So for me, part of it was, like, it seemed like it was motivated by, like, racist sexism. It was motivated by what I worry about is in terms of polarized partisanship, that because this is an out partisan, somebody is marked as, like, easy to identify for an attack simply because they're an other. So it's another way of doing othering. Like, so in addition to the gender, in addition to race, in addition to, like, not being a liberal, everybody's like, nyuk, nyuk, this is, like, totally great. So I'm looking at all of these things and seeing, like, these are the things that makes me worry about, like, Canadian democracy and, like, just, like, the trajectory of Canadian democracy. I'm based in Alberta, so I'm looking at I'm thinking about this in the context of Alberta's 2019 election, where, like, the United Conservative Party had to dump a white supremacist candidate the day before the election and then proceeded to have, like, 25 plus problems with candidates on the grounds of race or homophobia or misogyny. And it didn't mean anything because polarized partisanship. It was more like, well, at least they're not New Democrats, right? And so I'm looking at this in BC being like, oh, great, our democratic norms aren't resilient to this. So there's all of that. And then there's the total nonsense, like, non-apology, where it's like, apologies are not always going to work in politics, because sometimes people do things that, like, you can apologize for them, but you still have to face the consequences for it. But there's always space for, that was really ignorant of me, I'm really sorry, I clearly need to learn, and I promise to do better. right? And like, say what you want about, say, the prime minister with the whole blackface incident during the 2019 election, like that wasn't handled in a super sparkly way either. But like, at least there's like an effort at a sincere apology, which didn't come until like an hour after the nonsense apology in this particular case in BC had come up. And so I feel like this shouldn't have to be that hard, you know, like, you don't go and like hypersexualize your colleague in politics on like using a racist trope. Like, you just don't do that. It's really easy to not do that, actually. You don't have to put the effort, you have to put effort into being like this. It's also really easy to like actually just issue a decent apology when you mess up. Like, it's actually just not that hard. Honestly, it's not that hard. And then the other thing is that it's also not that hard to actually see like people who are not part of your preferred partisan group as like humans. And like people that you shouldn't be attacking just because they happen to not be on your team in politics either. Like, I'd like to think that a lot of everything about that could have just been so easily avoided, and that it wasn't, like, says something pretty clear about where our politics is these days.
And a comment that I found in your News 1130 article really interesting is you said, quote, in order to actually get candidates that represent what Canadians or British Columbians look like, parties have to be prepared to say no to candidates who are older white men, basically because they're the ones who will volunteer first. Can you kind of expand on that for a bit?
So this comes from a lot of political science research in Canada about candidate emergence and candidate nominations. What we know about nominations is that many of them are by acclamation, like the overwhelming majority of them, people are acclaimed. And what usually ends up happening, and what I think we'd like to think, is that it's those candidates that have no chance of winning. And this is the thing, most people who run for office are guaranteed to lose. And I really wish people would be nicer to them, because it's not the funnest way to spend like 2 months running for office, for all of the reasons like that like sparked this whole interview in the first place, right? Like, be nice to your candidates, even if you don't like them. Criticize their positions, but don't like attack them personally because they're doing democratic service. Anyway, people usually volunteer, and they, you know, volunteer knowing that they're gonna lose. What the more that we interrogate like who, what this looks like when like districts are really competitive, or they anticipate that a race is going to be really competitive, and when we interview organizers who've worked for parties that have actually fielded a number of candidates that look much more like the whole population, right? So you see more women, you see more racialized folks, you see more racialized women, you see more Indigenous folks. One of the things that we would ask is be like, so what did you do differently this time compared to the times before? And they'll say things like, the direction comes from the leader. And this is why I think it's fair for people to hold leaders responsible for incidents like what happened to Bowen Ma, because leaders set the tone. And you'll see in that call, the leader is there and the leader is doing nothing. And so organizers will say, well, the leader said, I would really like to get this done. And so that means that they're people who are helping like local associations find candidates, doing candidate vetting, things along those lines. They take this and they apply that to how they do their process. And then the other thing they said was, we had to say to the people who would come forward first that we wouldn't necessarily just accept them as candidates, that we were going to leave nominations open for a longer period of time to see if anybody else came forward. And we know from research from folks at Carleton, so Scott Prusers, he's actually at Dalhousie now, but Bill Cross, they looked at like what has to happen for a woman to be like present in, like any woman to be present in a candidate nomination race. And one of them is like leaving like the length of time, like how long the nomination is open. And so this is the thing. If you see people, a Sea Party, like proliferating their candidates really quickly, this tells you that they're not leaving the nomination process open very long. What they're doing is they're taking the first volunteer. And the things that we know is that men are much more likely to volunteer. And usually some people interpret this as like men just have more ambition to have an elected political career. And I think sometimes that's a reasonable interpretation, but I also like the alternative interpretation, which is that men are overconfident, and like some men like massively overestimate their political skills, or like they have an ego that's involved that gets them to go. Other research shows that who's doing the asking matters. So if you only have like white men recruiting, white men are much more likely to respond favorably to that ask. The other thing that I would highlight in this too is work that I know is coming through peer review. It's by Erin Talley at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. And one of the things that she looked at was she looked at federal nominations across gender and race in districts that have at least 15% of the voters are not white. And one of the things that we can find for all parties is that as soon as you get 50% of the voters in a district as being like not white, suddenly everybody can find a candidate who's not white too. And when I've asked organizers about this, I was just like, interesting. So if it's like 49% like racialized voters, you still are running your white candidates, but like it hits 50 and suddenly you can, how does like, explain this to me? And like, quote, we recruit on diversity when it matters. And that was a left-leaning party. And so I would point out that like, not everybody is good on this, but also like parties kind of know when they actually have to put effort into like not taking the first white dude who volunteers. So, but that particular work that by my colleague out in Toronto, when you're looking at those districts that have at least 15% racialized voters, one of the things that comes through really clearly is that like white men still have this like trajectory where like they're just way overrepresented even in those districts. Racialized women are the ones that are least recruited, so they're least likely to come forward. I think honestly for self-interested reasons, right? Like this case highlights that women who want to go into politics and racialized women going into politics know that they get like the intersectional whammy on this one. Like they're strategic, they're self-interested, and those that actually agree to do this, they know what they're getting into, right? There's other research that confirms this too. But the really interesting thing is you can see when parties do like put effort into recruitment, again, in these districts that have like a good chunk of racialized voters in them, racialized men volunteer to run at a higher rate than their demographic weight. Like there's way more, like, so you can see like she tracks it by population, people who aspire to be a candidates, and then it actually getting elected. And for racialized men, they spike at being aspirants and then they drop for actual like nominated candidates. But for white women, it's the reverse where they're like, they're not volunteering at the same rate as racialized men, but parties are promoting them. And so this is why I think it's like, it's really important to think about this in context of like, you can't just look at gender. You have to look at the gendered and racialized dynamics or the racialized dynamics of gender, right? Because parties are like just putting a white woman forward isn't like doing equity and diversity. This isn't making candidates like get candidates to represent like the diversity of Canadians, particularly if you've got racialized men that are coming forward and parties are, it looks like they're actually actively, I'm not going to say that they're actually actively blocking some of those candidacies, but it's really difficult to avoid thinking that that's actually what's happening.
So in your most recent paper, mm-hmm. Mediated, is that how you pronounce that?
Mediated.
Mediated, yeah. Ambitions. Yeah. In study one, you found that exposure to sexualized coverage about a politician's appearance and style rather than policy and substance does not dampen political ambition among female participants.
Yeah.
Women expressed low levels of ambition regardless of condition. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of explain that finding a bit?
So one of the things about gender gap research, in addition to it being binaried out, which is problematic for gender diversity, but what people tend to do is they focus on the gap more than the levels. And so the first thing I want to say is that the levels of ambition are low everywhere, and we should be concerned about that. Where people who would be excellent as elected representatives that are looking at electoral politics and being like, hard pass, that's bad. But like of the people who do say, yeah, I'd be interested in running for office someday, men are much more likely to say that they are than women. So in that particular piece, one of the things that we were looking at is trying to interrogate reasons why, because we don't have necessarily a good handle on this. It's not due to things like resources. So you can have women and men that have access to the same amount of resources and you still see the gap. It's not about kids. It's not about family. It's not about religion. Like we really have like looked at this quite considerably. And so it was just like, okay, so if it's not like anything about the women, and I get really annoyed with this argument where people are like, just lean in, or like women just need to be more confident. Then they'll like run at the same rates of men. And that will like, we just need to fix women and then we'll fix this problem. This is not what the research shows. One of the things that they do show though, is that women are more election averse. As in like, they actually just, they're much more skeptical about going through the process of an election. And again, the case that sparked this interview, like, gives us a pretty good reason why. And so one of the things that we did was we wanted to see, well, is reporting about, like, what's actually happening to women in politics, is this what's driving down women's level of political ambition? As in, can we actually, like, expose participants to information that will drive down their ambition, like, even in the moment? And we suspect, we know from other research that, like, we just presented a news article in this study, and the effects are fleeting. So we're not, like, actually, like, forcing women's ambitions lower in the long term. But this was our hypothesis. Our hypothesis was, let's show some, like, egregiously sexualized content of a politician that was actually published in Canada. And we expected that women's ambition would drop. And so the study, the article that we did an edited version of a piece that was published in the Globe and Mail during the inaugural Conservative Party of Canada leadership contest. And it was about Belinda Stronach. So Stephen Harper ultimately won that race, but Belinda Stronach, attractive, blonde, wealthy, like, auto parts heiress kind of thing. She was running second. She was a political outsider, which is common for leadership contests. But she was also kind of, like, heavily presented in terms of how she appeared. And so this particular article was written by, it was a column written by a woman, where it literally said, like, here she is making a policy announcement on this day. Forget what she had to say. More importantly, what was she wearing? All we did was, like, edit out, like, extraneous sentences, because it was really, like, a rambling column, but it was still published in the Globe and Mail. So all we did was just, like, edit it down to, like, 140 words. And then we changed the names, and then we tried to flip it so that we were had an instance where the politician in question was a woman. Like, that was basically, like, our edited version of the exact text, like, where we're literally just, like, cutting content out. We're not adding anything. And then when we flipped it, we changed the gender of the reporters and the politician. So it's a man who's being sexualized, but the people doing the sexualizing in the article are women. So instead of, like, Mr. Olson, we say Ms. Olson, things along those lines. And one of those, I think it was Don Martin, was quoted in the original article as saying that Ms. Stronach had bodacious good looks. And we're like, what's the masculine equivalent for this? Because we don't want to make him look like he's a surfer. One of the things that comes through very clearly about this is that it's difficult to, you can't just flip a sexist article about, written about a woman, and make it just be about a man. Because sexism doesn't work that way. Like, men don't experience sexism. They just don't. Like, it's very much directed at women. Anyway, so we thought that reading about, like, the original article, we thought reading that, where it's the sexualized woman in politics, would drive down women's ambition. It turns out that wasn't the case. And so the women in the study didn't react at all. Like, there was just no difference between participants who, like, read nothing and those who read that particular story, which leads us to conclude that perhaps women's ambition is at the floor. Or, like, but, like, the other side of this is important too, because when we saw, what we did see was that men's ambition, when they read about the sexualized man, not the woman, just the sexualized man, when they were treated, like, when they read, like, an egregiously trivializing article about a man in politics, their ambition dropped down to women's levels. And so for me, what's the story here? Is the story that, like, women's ambition is too low? Or is it the story that politics is masculine and there's privilege that comes from that? And this might have been the first time that the participants in the study had encountered men in politics being treated like women. And I should say that it's very clear in the study that we're talking about, like, we're talking about Stephanie and Stephen. And so we're not cueing race in this, but I think it's reasonable to say that most participants see them as white. And most participants, like, this was a student sample at a university in Ontario, most of our participants were white too. And so in that sense, it's like the most, like, overrepresented group in politics, white men, once they get, like, get the treatment, like, one instance of seeing them being treated just the same way that, like, in this egregious kind of way, like, I don't want to say that women in politics get treated this way all the time, but reading that one news story, when it brings them down to women's levels, like, the ambition gap there, I think it's reasonable to interpret it as, like, a privilege gap or an overconfidence gap or something where it's just kind of like, oh, I have never thought that these attacks might be directed at me instead of, like, everybody else.
So going into, like, a more vague question, what are the main reasons why we see such a large gender gap in politics?
So, like, why do we see this? Like, why is the representation gap, at least in electoral institutions, still so, like, persistent and huge? Like, I keep thinking, if there was any other field where it was supposed to be about, like, under, like, democratic norms like this, right? Where it's supposed to be about representing ideas and, like, best local candidate or whatever, all these other sorts of things. White men's overrepresentation is shocking. Like, it is shockingly high. So why do we still see it? There's a couple of reasons. I think political parties, like the people who are actually going about and doing this kind of organizing, they don't see a penalty for continuing to do this badly. So until voters are prepared to sanction parties broadly for, like, only running or disproportionately running, like, white men of a certain age and a certain sexual orientation, like the straight white guy with, like, the grandkids, until parties are penalized for, like, offering way more of those candidates than ones that actually look like other people in Canada, they're not going to change. The other thing is that leaders don't necessarily prioritize this. And the role of leaders becomes really clear because you can see that we'll make gains and then the leader changes or the leader changes their minds and then you backslide again. So you can see this with the Conservative Party of Canada under Stephen Harper, where in the mid-aughts, I have it on good authority, but I don't have it on ethics clearance, so I haven't published it. But, like, people were saying that, like, the leader in that instance said, the number of women that we're running is embarrassingly low. We need to do something about this. And, like, one of the ways that you do this is that in federal politics, a candidate for a federal political party unless the leader's prepared to sign the nomination papers. And so leaders can say, I'm not signing your district's nomination papers for that candidate until you demonstrate to me that you actually did a candidate search and that you actually can't find, like, no women are prepared to run for you, that no racialized folks are prepared to run for you, that literally the only people that you can find are these, like, old white grandpas. So leaders have that power to do that. So you can see that, like, women's numbers for the Conservative Party of Canada as candidates, they go up really quite considerably in the mid-aughts, and then they go right back down as soon as they stop doing that policy, right? I think one of the reasons why this continues to be a problem is that people assume that it fixes itself, and it doesn't. You actually have to take deliberate action on it. And, like, you need to take deliberate action. So it's this combination of action plus sanction. If there's no sanction for not acting, it's really easy for somebody to say, I'm not going to act on it. And the difficult, like, if somebody's sitting there and saying, but, like, this just seems like, why would you, like, why does this matter? Like, what's the problem with having, like, so few women in these political institutions? Or why is it a problem that these institutions are, like, way whiter than the Canadian population actually is itself? Like, that, like, you can just see, like, women and their diversity are not present the way that they need to be. And the reason why is that people bring information into these institutions based on their experiences, and those experiences are policy relevant. And, like, sometimes I'm prepared to not give people the benefit of the doubt when they're writing policy, and you can see that it is clearly designed to benefit some people and some people only. But I think it's, like, sometimes I will give them the benefit of the doubt where they just, like, aren't considering the information that they need to actually write a policy that doesn't have unintended negative consequences or unintentionally leaves, like, whole swaths of people out because they might not be considering the information that they need. Now, the civil service can, like, pull some of this information in for policymaking, and they do. But it's the political actors and the politicians that get elected that choose to act on that advice from the civil service or not. And so one of the hopes is that if you actually have, like, the more experience you have in the room, like, based on, like, people's lived experience, the more that you have that in the room, the better those choices are going to be. I'm living in Alberta right now, and I will be very clear that under Jason Kenney, I don't think that the government of Alberta cares very much about race, and I don't think they care very much about gender. They obviously don't care about education either. And so if I'm looking at their, like, pandemic recovery plan, it's very much geared at a certain kind of disproportionately white guy that works in oil and gas extraction only, and it's to the exclusion of everybody else. So the hostility directed at the public service, the hostility directed at, like, requests for childcare, the hostility directed at professions that are disproportionately dominated by women, like, it really speaks to the fact that if they cared about gender and if they cared about equity, they would be making different policy choices, right? Ultimately, this comes down to, like, this doesn't get better because the people who are the critical actors who would be empowered to do better don't face a sanction for not doing better. And that sanction comes from us. Like, I think people massively underestimate the power that they have to work on this and to do better on this. And as individual people, if we all said, this is nonsense, you have to do better on this, they would. And this is, like, to get back to the incident that sparked all of this, this is why the leader sitting there silently or, like, giggling along with it, why this is the problem, because that's the actor in the room that had the ability and the power to, like, make that not happen or to apply a sanction when that happened. And when they choose to abdicate that responsibility and they choose to abdicate that power, then this is why nothing changes, right?
What can the average voter actually do in terms of action and sanctioning?
I think the average voter underestimates the power of, like, an email to a politician saying, I'm not voting for you because of this thing. I can't do that as somebody who has, like, a public profile and a position at a university, because they'll be like, oh, that's just the gender scholar being like, meh, right? Like, I pick and choose when I send something on letterhead to a politician. Like, it's a different consideration, fair. But for the average person to be like, this is the example I'll use. When my spouse writes to politicians as, like, just kind of like Joe Public and just says, this is my concern and I don't think that you're being responsive to it, he gets responses in ways that I don't. When I write as an expert and I was just like, as an expert, I have the evidence to say that your policy choice is problematic for these reasons. They're just like, we're going to file 13 you and ignore you because you're not one of the experts that we want to listen to. But when it's like random person is like, I'm your constituent and I'm seeing this and I don't like the choice that you made and I don't like the justification that you gave me. And I want you to, like, tell me what you're going to do in response to my opposition to this. And also know that if you give me an inadequate response, I'm not voting for you. Like, that threat of, like, the voters being like, I can take your position away and I will, if you don't do better on this. Like, people don't want to do that because it just feels super ineffective if it's just one person. But if you get, like, 50 emails to the office that all say the same thing, all from regular folk, those staff start to take notice. The people that they work for, like, those elected representatives start to take notice. And this is the other thing. And I can tell that I've got a very Alberta approach on this because, like, Albertans don't like what's going on. And when they don't like what's going on, they just kind of throw their hands up in the air and, like, disengage completely. And I can understand rationally why some folks need to do that sometimes, but I would always go back to the power is in your vote and the power is in your participation. And, like, protest is a perfectly legitimate form of political participation. So is how you spend your money. So is how you do a whole bunch of things. Like, everything is political because there's power in all of this stuff, right? So, like, if you people care about this, like, find all the places where you can exercise your little bit of power and do it.
Well, thank you again for speaking to me and giving me so much of your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This is always a big, always a good fun time to be able to do this stuff. I really appreciate it.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants?
What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
Carnegie Community Action Project is based out of the downtown east side. We work to help people fight gentrification, increase the welfare rates, as well as to fight for the rights of the people of the downtown east side. Please join our cause.
Please come to the CCAP volunteer meetings every Friday at 11:15, the Carnegie Community Center on the third floor. Thank you very much.
Housing now for the Oppenheimer homeless.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute. Just visit CITR.ca/discorder/contribute. You can grab it around town or read it at discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
Welcome back to On the Point, CITR's weekly news show. You just heard Isaac's interview with Melanie Thomas. To follow up, Alex Trabulsi will be doing a breakdown of the gender makeup of candidates running in Vancouver.
Yeah, so here's some just basic numbers that I took from the ridings of Vancouver, Richmond, and Surrey regarding the makeup of the sex of the party candidates. So in Vancouver, there are 11 total ridings. There are 11 NDP candidates, 6 of them are women, 5 of them are men. In the safe ridings, when we sort of dive down deeper, the safe ridings, there are 5 men, 4 women, and the NDP likely riding has a female candidate. In the only BC Liberal safe riding, which is the riding of Vancouver-Kilchenna, there is also a woman being run against Andrew Wilkinson. There are 11 Green candidates, 7 women, 4 men, and 11 Liberal candidates, all of whom are men. Going over to Richmond, there are 4 NDP candidates, and there are only 4 ridings total. 3 are men, 1 is a woman, and there are 2 NDP-leaning ridings. There's one woman being run in one, and one man being run in one. There are 4 Liberal candidates, 2 men and 2 women, and there are only 2 Green candidates, both of whom are men. Going east to Surrey, there are 9 total ridings, 9 NDP candidates, 6 men, 3 women. The 4 men and only 2 of the women are in safe ridings. The 4 men. 4 of the men are in the NDP safe ridings. The 3rd woman is running in a BC Liberal leaning riding. There are 9 Liberal candidates, 8 men, 1 woman. The only woman is running in her own riding. She's the incumbent. There are only 6 Green candidates, even split, 3 men, 3 women. It's important to note that these 3 regions I listed off alone provide 24 of the 87 total seats in the legislature. So there's a potential to contribute quite a bit to the diversity for the makeup of the sex of members of the legislature. And we've talked about the provincial election a lot on this show, including the mistakes and scandals cropping up across the political aisle. Most recently, we talked about John Horgan saying he doesn't see color when it came to Indigenous people, and Nathan Cullen, who is an NDP candidate, and his comments about his Haida opponent.
But it seems that that's the only way Indigenous people have been mentioned this election as collateral damage, as another diverse vote banked to not offend. Considering the history of Canada and British Columbia, we don't really need to go into how that's disrespectful to history in the current moment. Actually, has an interview about this aspect of the election campaign, how Indigenous issues became just another issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I noticed about the media coverage at large of this election. And I wanted to find out what an election campaign would look like if politicians really took into account Indigenous perspectives and not just a sort of settler colonial mindset. And so that's why I talked to Dr. Cheryl Lightfoot. She advises the UBC president on Indigenous affairs. And I talked to her about what that would look like, what a campaign like that would look like. And she also spoke about the United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples and the outlook for Indigenous people after this election. So let's have a listen.
So just for the listeners, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Cheryl Lightfoot, and I am a professor here at UBC, and I am in the departments of political science and Indigenous studies with a temporary assignment also in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. I'm a Canada Research Chair of Global Indigenous Rights and Politics, and I also hold a partial appointment as Senior Advisor to the President on Indigenous Affairs. And personally, I'm Anishinaabe from the Lake Superior Band of Ojibwe.
I'm obviously, you must have been following the election, and you know, I talked about some of the things earlier on about how it's being covered. How's it been from your perspective?
Well, actually, I share some of your frustration, and it's actually been a bit disheartening to see some of the points related to Indigenous peoples in this election being framed as issues, as if Indigenous peoples are simply another public interest group or NGO or a lobbying entity. And the fact is that Indigenous human rights are just that, they are human rights. And it's very strange and, like I say, disheartening and some days depressing that Canadian society still has a tendency to believe that a set of Indigenous rights are up for political negotiation, or that this should be a political discussion, when it's actually a set of rights that are globally recognized now as inherent and belonging to Indigenous peoples. Therefore, it's the responsibility of government and society to uphold those and affirm those, not to debate and discuss them.
Yeah, and talking about, you know, debates, actually, there was a leaders debate I want to say a week ago. And, you know, in that Indigenous issues, I did just from my own basic research, I think they weren't talked about as an issue, if you could talk about it that way, until like 40 minutes into the debate. And before that, they were talking about all sorts of other things. So, like, what does that sort of tell you about the priorities of the leaders right now?
Well, and I'm going to quote Cheryl Casimir from the First Nations Summit, who was tracking the minute by minute. And she noted that it took a full 45 minutes into the debate for anything Indigenous to be mentioned, even at first blush. And so she expressed her frustration, and I'm just going to echo that because I think that's quite appalling, because it has been a very active couple of years on the territory of Indigenous rights in British Columbia. And of course, we have seen in the past several years, both some highs and lows from the current government. And those are all noted by Indigenous peoples and Indigenous voters. And many Indigenous voters are trying to really grapple with the reality of those highs and lows, because they are quite extreme. And on the one hand, the DRIPA Act, what we call it for short, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act, did pass unanimously in the legislature not even a year ago. That was November of 2019. And yet at the same time, we see issues like Site C Dam moving ahead. We had the RCMP moving into Wet'suwet'en territory. This is quite a juxtaposition. And those who vote in the Indigenous world really have to grapple with how to balance those two extremes. And for the fact that it didn't show up on anyone's radar until 45 minutes into a debate, again, is disheartening. I think it indicates a disappointing lack of seriousness by all the parties. And that's been noted by a number of Indigenous leaders as I've been following the news and following their tweets and the conversation in the public realm.
Yeah, and so tell me more about the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, because, you know, you did mention it was passed unanimously last year, and John Horgan was asked about it earlier this year, and he said, asked about the implementation, and he said, I couldn't implement it, there was a pandemic, or something along those lines, which was frankly amazing to see. So, like, how have you seen that sort of... So obviously the NDP, you know, talked a good game about passing it. What about implementation? How has that looked?
Well, and to be fair, passing it was a historic moment. This was the first jurisdiction in Canada, in the English-speaking world, to take that step and pass a piece of legislation that... And in and of itself, the legislation is not meant to implement the declaration. It's not meant to just enshrine it in law immediately. What the legislation has done is set out a process of co-design, co-development with Indigenous peoples in BC. So I think that was the right step, and it's one that most everyone welcomed. The trouble is, a comment like that sounds very glib to everyone, because A pandemic actually doesn't take away the urgency. A pandemic amplifies the urgency of implementing, again, a set of human rights. So what other set of human rights is still negotiable in Canadian society? I'm not aware of I'm not aware of another set or body of human rights that have been fully affirmed globally multiple times that is still a policy issue or a political question in Canada. And then I heard little bits from BC Liberals saying that they would like to begin implementing the declaration as much as is possible. And I'm struck going, what do you mean? This is a set of human rights. It's your obligation to implement the entirety of it and figure out what it means in Canadian society and in the BC context. So I continue to be frustrated by some of the discourses. And again, it's that gap that we see of inconsistency. So on the one hand, we can celebrate the real steps forward and the intent to do co-development and co-design, which is everything that was asked for. And yet, at the same time, with the other hand, continuing a practice of, I think we could call it unconscious or subconscious colonialism, because we certainly see that coming out in discourses across the political spectrum.
And that sort of that was reflected in sort of the NDP's actions thus far in government, right? I mean, you talked about Site C going ahead, you talked about the Wet'suwet'en land defense. And something that struck me about that was Nathan Cullen was one of the sort of negotiators for the BC government with the Wet'suwet'en peoples. Mm-hmm. And he has been in the news recently for his comments about the Haida Gwaii BC Liberal candidate. Do you think, again, that's sort of par for the course?
It is something that we see in the political spectrum, and not just in Canada, to be fair. Other countries that I watch closely, like Australia, New Zealand, and the US, there is a struggle by all political parties on the entire spectrum, from the far right to the far left, still struggle with the concept of colonialism and how to decolonize. And I think for everyone, from wherever they're starting from, they have tremendous work to do. It's similar to anti-racist work. It's so embedded in people's education, thought process, socialization, that it just is going to take a tremendously long time to roll that back and undo that and begin thinking a different way. And again, to be fair, there are policies that different parties bring forward at different times that are positive. The trouble from the Indigenous perspectives are that you can't rely on that 100%, because more often than not, every time you have what we would call a legal or a policy victory, there'll be a backslide. So it often is two steps forward, one step back.
And on that topic, obviously the NDP is currently looking comfortable. They're probably going to win this election. What is the sort of outlook on that perspective? Because in the 3 years, there's been the, you know, Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act, there's been, you know, progress in some other areas like childcare. But again, as you said, there have been, you know, two steps forward, one step back. What do you see happening probably when the NDP wins on Sunday?
Yeah, and like I said, Indigenous voters around the province have been grappling with this, because on the one hand, and you can hear many, if you look up media pieces, you can see quotes by Grand Chief Stuart Phillip and the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, which is made up of chiefs from all around the province. And they have really spent a lot of time thinking about this and considering it, because on the one hand, they are deeply critical of the NDP's record on both Wet'suwet'en land defense and Site C, but ultimately they're throwing support behind the NDP because, and what they are telling us, and I'll quote Terry Teagee here from the BCAFN, is that on balance, the NDP has made more progress working with them in the last couple of years than the previous government, who held power for 16 years. And what they are saying at all levels of this leadership is that Indigenous peoples and voters tend not to always be partisan. They're looking for a party that will work with them, not necessarily represent them. And on balance at the moment, all of those leaders are as much as one would expect to see in this mixed environment, tending to throw support behind the NDP. And the reason is, and if you look online, you can find the first report on the DRIPA Act that was released second half of the summer. I can't remember whether it was late July, early August, but it's very recently. And if you take a look at that report, you can see there have been quite a few policy steps forward and changes made that are in alignment with Indigenous leadership's expectations. So they are looking to continue that. And even though a lot of those pieces don't make the news because they are often, you know, policy wonk type people sitting in rooms negotiating a particular line or a couple lines in a new law or a policy, that's not always newsworthy. But yeah, it is important, and the leaders who are working on these things do see some forward motion that they feel positive about and confident about. And in the atmosphere of the pandemic as well, they have been working hard to and pushing the province to share data and to expand. And there's a tremendous investigation going on right now, a historic investigation on racism in the healthcare system. And the NDP has been very cooperative and rolled out an impressive set of advisories and investigative team. So there is space there to work productively together, even if they don't always get it right.
You talked about how you've been sort of disappointed with the way the politicians are treated Indigenous rights as an issue, as a diversity thing almost. How would it look like if they started taking this, almost fundamentally changing it? How would you think a leaders debate or an issue would look like if they took that Indigenous perspective in mind?
Well, I would prefer to see it appear in, of course, opening statements. I would like to have the ongoing developing relationship between the province and Indigenous nations in BC go that next level. And one of the pieces in the DRIPA Act that was, again, notable and historic was the provision that the province could begin negotiating with Indigenous governing bodies that weren't necessarily just elected chiefs and council. And that is a fundamental transformation in how the Crown has done business since ever. And I would really like to see that moment come to fruition. And I'd like to see all of the parties, and again, it was a unanimous piece of legislation. So it wasn't just the NDP putting that legislation forward. Each and every party in BC put their stamp on it. I would like to see that taken up seriously as a conversation about what resetting the relationship in British Columbia would look like. That is tremendously important and timely because, again, in the pandemic, we have seen Indigenous nations here exercising their self-determination and moving in different ways than the province and moving in ways that they feel is appropriate for them and ways to protect their people. I would like to see the province embrace that and see where it can go.
So not just a land acknowledgement then?
Really working fundamentally on deepening of relationships, working towards joint decision-making, co-management, co-governance. This is what is the wave of the future. And I would prefer to see that coming in the first 2 to 5 minutes of a conversation, not 45.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
and the Skakuya, Talitin, who Musqueam Mustayo. I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking for one.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
Welcome back to On The Point, your source of alternative and undercover news in the Lower Mainland. Let's shift away from provincial politics and talk about Vancouver city politics now. Grace, tell us about the protest at the Art Gallery last weekend.
Hundreds of anti-mask protesters congregated in Vancouver this past weekend for what organizers called the Mega Freedom Rally. The event opposed censorship, lockdowns, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, social distancing, contact tracing, and government orders. British Columbia does not have a mask or vaccine mandate, and was never in lockdown. Many participants spread myths about how wearing a mask is harmful. Some claimed, without evidence, that they even cause cancer. The consensus among scientists is that masks are not only safe, they drastically reduce the risk of spreading COVID-19. Many protesters touted flags and signs supporting the baseless conspiracy theory QAnon, which claims that Donald Trump is saving the world from a cabal of Satan-worshipping cannibal pedophiles. They believe an anonymous Trump insider going by Q is releasing cryptic information predicting an awakening that will cause the mass imprisonment of Democratic public figures, aka the cabal of Satan-worshipping cannibal pedophiles. The ideas of QAnon have their roots in much older anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, so it might not surprise you to learn that anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist David Icke was among the advertised speakers at the rally. Icke is known for his belief that most major world leaders are a race of reptilian aliens. BC Libertarian Party President Donald Wilson was also present, telling Global News he attended the rally because the virus's hospitalization and death rates don't justify restrictions on the public. As of this writing, COVID-19 has killed 256 people in British Columbia and has infected thousands more. 499 new cases were reported over the weekend.
I just have a question. How would the masks cause cancer? Like, what's the science behind that? What are they saying?
I really don't know. I know they think that, like, it causes your carbon dioxide intake to increase, or like that it's keeping bacteria in, and apparently that causes cancer, which it doesn't, but they say that it does.
What?
Yikes.
Yeah, the carbon dioxide, and also it's like it's apparently like going to restrict your airflow, so that like if you're in an they were protesting outdoors anyway, but if they were indoors, apparently you're going to like lose your breath and just pass out, apparently, even though that isn't how any of it works. But yeah.
And this is looking past the fact that there are anti-Semitic speakers there. Like, that's a much bigger thing to grasp onto, as well as the fact that a party in provincial politics had a member there.
Yeah, I was very surprised to see that the president of the Libertarian Party was there.
Like, there is so many layers to bad things going on here that there's no way to dive into all of it, but just yeah, yikes. That's all I got, just yikes.
Yikes sums it up.
And I mean, talking about candidates who are there, there's actually a BC Liberal candidate who emailed one of the conspiracy theorists about advocating against emergency public health restrictions. So this is, I'm reading off a report by Press Progress, and the incumbent BC Liberal candidate for the Chaco Lakes, John Rustad, and so this guy received a letter from one of the conspiracy theorists, Tony Mitra. Let me just look at the response. So the response was, "Dear Tony Mitra, thank you for your email. As a practice, I've always answered my own emails, blah, blah, blah." And then he says, "The freedoms we have as a society should be one of our more cherished possessions. During the serious COVID-19 pandemic, those freedoms have been significantly restricted. And I can tell you that I'm advocating for the removal of those restrictions as quickly as can be." And, we talked about the BC Liberal caucus not having a good time. This is just another example of that. I mean, he's probably going to get reelected, but not fun. Not fun at all.
Yeah, just yikes. I mean, I know people want the freedom to move, but surely people who have compromised immune systems have the freedom to live? Is there something I'm missing here, or what's going on?
Yeah, and you know what is so insane to me about the protests that are happening right now is that at the start of this pandemic in British Columbia, a lot of the cases were restricted to care homes and hospitals and like outbreaks at plants and stuff like that, sort of removed from the general public in many ways, right? It wasn't circulating in our community. But right now, when the virus is circulating in our community, is when these protests are happening, which makes it way worse than like any other scenario. And we were under lockdown, we weren't told to be under lockdown, but most of us were self-isolating throughout that initial period, and now it's even worse. So this the timing of this protest and everything about it is just so irresponsible. I can't get over it.
Compounding that effect is that it's not just people from Vancouver at the protest. People came in from all around the country, and they're going to bring it back to wherever they came from, and we'll be here for another 6 months.
What? Like, these people want to be, like, oppressed so badly. What? Okay, I just, like, reread what, like, the event opposes. So censorship, lockdowns, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, social distancing, contact tracing, and government orders. What?
Yep.
Censorship of what? Yeah, like...
I don't know. I grabbed this quote from their Facebook page, and this was just in bullet points in all caps.
The government is not allowing me to call it the... Like, just... Associating associating COVID with Chinese people, I assume, is their issue with calling it censorship, is my immediate assumption, seeing how they have no qualms with having anti-Semites in their midst.
How can some people want to be oppressed so badly that they invent these sort of things? Anyway, speaking of privileged people protesting, the overdose prevention site in Yaletown we talked about last week on the show finally got passed despite the opposition of some concerned residents and some members of council.
Yep, the final site passed with a 7-4 vote in council. There was a bit of a controversy because the previous managers of the site, Rain City, they pulled out to allow Vancouver Coastal Health to run the site. But the final site, you know, did finally get approved despite the opposition of people like Sam Sullivan, you know, former mayor of Vancouver and current BC Liberal candidate for Vancouver Falls Creek, and the Vancouver Police Department. They also opposed it, but finally got passed. Talking about Sullivan, he's probably going to lose his seat in the election tomorrow, according to 338 Canada. And, you know, yeah, I just said the election is tomorrow as the show goes out. So let's get into the hot takes. What are we all thinking? I mean, polls are showing sort of a shortening, it's still a comfortable NDP majority, but the lead is sort of being shortened by the Greens getting momentum more than the Liberals sort of getting momentum. So what are we all thinking? I mean, the results of the election might be delayed for a few weeks, but it's likely that we'll know who's the winner come Saturday. So, well, what it's been, we've covered this election for, you know, almost a month on the show now. Just thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of good that the Greens are gaining momentum. I mean, this is not, for me, I'm in Wilkinson's riding. So for me, it's not an election of who I like more. It's the election of who I like, who I can afford to dislike more. I'm not a big fan of the Liberals. I'm not a big fan of the NDP. They've made decisions that I do not agree with, but I'd much rather stay under an NDP government, and it's unlikely that a Green is going to be elected in Wilkinson's riding, so I voted for the NDP candidate. Unless, of course, my vote gets discounted because there's an error in my signature, which is all my fault, but, you know...
I feel like this election has been a mess, which, like, every election is a mess, but this election, like, so many things are happening, especially, like, with the BC Liberals, and I know we're supposed to be, like, impartial and, like, whatnot, but honestly, I'm just, like, when news first broke out I remember talking to you guys and being like, wouldn't it be so funny, like, not saying it's good, but wouldn't it be so funny and such a slap in the face if, like, Horgan lost? But, like, looking at what the BC Liberals are doing, it's just like, I don't think that was, like, on the table.
I mean, we also talked about Wilkinson losing, and his writing is actually much closer than we would have anticipated. Let me just bring it up. So,
I believe it was the NDP candidate was within the margin of error. And I think the margin of error is like 7.9 percent points, something around that. That's the last I checked, though.
So, give me a second. I'm just trying to... regional distribution, there we go. Yeah, so it, a 3-3 candidate does say it's close. So...
Which is hilarious.
Which is extremely hilarious. It's really, really funny. But yeah, I mean, we heard it earlier with the interview with Dr. Cheryl Lightfoot. I mean, this election is, I think it's going to be more of the same. There's a TIE article about this with the NDP. You know, there's, despite all of the game they've talked about, indigenous issues and, you know, workers' rights and all of that, I don't see any sort of substantial progress, even with the majority they're probably going to gain come the weekend. I don't know. Like, I don't mean to be like a Debbie Downer and say, oh, nothing's going to get better. But it's, I don't think anything's going to fundamentally change is all. And especially when it comes to marginalized folks. And I mean, I guess that's better than it getting worse. But is the status quo something that is good? I don't think so.
That's it for our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On the Point by CATR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bringing you local news. And stay tuned for more amazing programming.